From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Rachel Martin, sitting in for Guy Raz. It's been a tough week for the U.S. economy.
There really was a sense that the recovery was picking up steam until these newest numbers.
You can add the monthly unemployment report to a series of worse than expected economic
readings. The unemployment
rate
ticked up again to 9.1%.
Housing prices continue to fall.
It was just all downhill for stocks.
Another down day.
And it wasn't just stocks. Commodities, oil, all 10 industry groups in the S&P lower.
Really all the automakers taking a bit of a hit.
Consumer confidence in the tank.
Investors are spooked because unemployment claims came in above 400,000.
The stock market dropped again for the fifth week in a row, but it was the job numbers that really hit home. While millions of Americans have exceeded their unemployment benefit extensions, employers added just 54,000 jobs in May. That's the fewest in the last 8 months. President Obama was in Ohio yesterday pushing positive news about jobs, the jobs saved by the government bailout of the auto companies. He didn't talk about the latest jobs report, but he did acknowledge the broader economic problems.
This economy took a big hit. You know, it's just like if you had a bad illness, if you got hit by a truck, you know, it's going to take a while for you to mend. And that's what's happened to our economy. It's taking a while to mend.
For the millions who've been out of work for months on end, this is starting to feel like the new normal. That's our cover story today, pressing the reset button on America's economic reality.
My name is Teresa Raikovo. I'm 49 years old. I live in West Islip, New York. I was a dispatcher in the trucking business, handling hazardous material for the past 30 years. I started in high school in 1976. I lost my job in September of 2008. I expected that I would be back during that season. I didn't expect that, you know, I would be out of work for the whole winter and then the next winter and then the next winter. That was the difference, is that you don't really, while you're actually going through it, you're not realizing that this is the end of work or your work life or your career as you knew it. My unemployment was taken away from me in August of 2010. Millions of people like myself, and people especially in my age group, that are being phased out of the workforce. And if you get a job, you're only getting something at minimum wage with minimum benefits or mostly just part-time. I was living in a beautiful, beautiful waterfront apartment that I had worked very hard in my life to achieve to get there, and I've had to leave that and move into a very, very nice but very small studio that friends of mine had that have allowed me to stay there and have worked with me as far as the rent goes. It's not really rent. I really just help them out, you know, when I can. You know, you can't have guests over or have the holidays like I used to have and things like that. So, you know, everything's been an adjustment because life isn't the way it used to be.
That's Teresa Iacovo of Long Island, New York, who's adjusted her expectations to her new economic reality, something America as a whole may need to do. The unemployment rate is now up to 9.1%, and it's been hovering around that number or a little higher since early 2009. So does that mean the days of 4, 5, even 6% unemployment are nothing but a distant memory? I put that question to Felix Salmon, financial blogger for Reuters.
I cannot foresee any time in the future that we're going to get an unemployment rate below 7%. And remember that unemployment is not actually the really big worry here. It's employment which is the big worry.
Explain what that means.
Well, if you look at the total number of people who are working in the United States as a percentage of the total population, it's something known as the employment to population ratio. And it's been declining steadily for years. What that means is that those of us who have jobs are supporting more and more people without jobs. It doesn't really matter, economically speaking, whether you're looking for work or not. What matters is whether you have a job or not. And the unemployment rate only measures the people who are looking for work. It doesn't measure people who have just been completely discouraged and given up looking for work. If you've been out of work for 2 years, there are no jobs, no one will hire you, then you're magically not unemployed anymore as far as the numbers are concerned. But that doesn't help the economy. And so what we really want to be concentrating on is creating jobs. And although the unemployment rate is an important number, it's important to remember that it's only a subset of the people who aren't working.
What does the United States look like if we get to a point where we're living year after year with a permanent 8 or 9% unemployment rate?
It looks pretty unsustainable. I mean, look at Europe as a good example. They have permanently high unemployment rates in this neighborhood, and sometimes in the case of Spain or other countries in the Mediterranean, quite higher than this. But all of those countries have strong social safety nets, and that really isn't the case in the United States. And so, societally speaking, unemployment is much more damaging in the United States than it is in Europe. And so if we do wind up in a world where many, many more people are unemployed and unemployable, then we will have to look after those people somehow. And that's going to be extremely expensive, both societally and politically.
So that leads me to a question about expectations. I mean, for the past few years, I think it's safe to say that at an individual level, in a family unit, people have been continuously adjusting their expectations. Is the country as a whole doing that same calculus, and is it coming too late?
Well, no, we're not doing that calculus, and that's exactly the problem. We've been spending massively, and we've had this fallacy. We've been living on hope and dreams that somehow tax revenues are going to automatically appear even if we don't raise any taxes. And so at a government level, we've completely failed to grasp the realities of how much this economy costs to run and how much we're realistically ever going to be able to bring in with taxes at their current levels. And so we have this very unsustainable fiscal situation in terms of budget deficits.
What about that jump start we've really needed to get the economy moving? I mean, why can't we get there? And what is that?
Well, that's the second stimulus, which is needed and which is politically impossible. That's the large amount of spending on job creation, which will give people good long-term permanent jobs, make them confident in their future earning power, allow them to go out and spend money and start getting the economy moving again. And we have failed to do that. The only way we can really help jumpstart these things is fiscally, is by doing, you know, smart things like saying to companies, to the degree that you hire more people than you employ right now, we won't charge you payroll tax on those people. That kind of policy. But again, that's a stimulus, and stimulus is a dirty word in Washington right now.
All of this, of course, is happening in a very heated political season. We're anticipating a presidential election next year. How does the economy get fixed? How are any of these big issues addressed in this kind of political climate?
I cannot imagine that any of this is going to get addressed, that anything substantive is going to get done until the other side of the election. My guess is November 2012 at the earliest are we going to see anything useful happening.
That's Reuters finance blogger Felix Salmon. He joined us from our New York bureau. Felix, thanks very much.
Thank you.
But let's face it, learning to live with less is not exactly the best campaign slogan, which means President Obama may have a tough road ahead in his bid for re-election. As we've heard all week, no president since FDR has been re-elected with an unemployment rate above 7.2%. That's one of the reasons this president is asking voters for patience. But when I talked to NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley, he said there is a limit.
It's one thing to ask for patience in February of 2009 and something else to ask for patience in October of 2012.
Yeah.
I think less important than the actual number of the unemployment rate in the fall of next year is what the trend line has been, and maybe even more important, the way the American people perceive that trend line. And we were on a trend for a few months earlier this year that I think the White House felt somewhat encouraged by. We saw good job gains in February, in March, in April, and now we've seen this big slowdown in May. The president's own job may depend on whether that's just a one-month hiccup or if it's the sign of something more ominous to come.
Clearly, there's a sense that there needs to be some kind of bipartisan compromise in order to really jumpstart the economy. How do you do that? And at the same time, campaign on a message that our way is the right way and that things are really getting better.
Well, and the president's way has changed. I mean, if you think back to 2 years ago when this administration pushed through an aggressive stimulus package and then took the political risk of bailing out the automakers, Chrysler and General Motors, at a time when that was not popular. And that was something the president was, you know, claiming credit for, claiming good results for today. But there's really no appetite now in Washington, even among Democrats, for a repeat of that kind of big, aggressive government intervention in the economy. So in many ways, the White House is now singing from the Republicans' hymnal and saying, yes, we do need to get control of our deficit. We do need to cut federal spending. And in fact, if that's done carelessly, the cutback in government spending could be another drag on the economy. We've already seen that cuts in government spending at the state and local level have cost more than 400,000 jobs since September of 2008. But the big talking point that you hear in Washington is all about fiscal responsibility and not about the millions of people who are looking for work.
That's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley here in Washington. Scott, thanks very much.
Good to talk with you, Rachel.
There's a meetup planned at the Jefferson Memorial today. People are invited to bring their own music, listen to it on earbuds, and dance. Not sure the meetup began as a protest. It's become one now. In May, an appeals court ruled that the U.S. Park Police were right to arrest a woman named Mary Brooke Oberwetter for going to the Jefferson Memorial with a group of friends shortly before midnight on April 12, 2008, and silently dancing to salute Thomas Jefferson's 265th birthday. The court said that the dancing distracted from the atmosphere of solemn commemoration Park Service regulations uphold for all visitors. Miss Oberwetter, who's described herself as a libertarian, said dancing is free expression and that school children on a field trip create more noise and distraction. So a few more people went to the Jefferson Memorial to dance last Saturday. Five were arrested. It's painful to watch the video taken by one of the dancers. They do not cease and desist when the police order them to stop dancing. The officers subdue them by squishing them on hard marble floors to clap them into handcuffs. I guess the appeals court was saying that free speech doesn't give people the right to shout fire in a crowded theater or do the Macarena inside a solemn memorial. I have certainly seen park police, often quite courageously, uphold the rights of everyone, from nuns to Nazis, to express themselves however they want on the National Mall. But I find these memorial meetups put the parent in me at odds with my persevering inner child. The parent wants to tell kids, if you make a scene at a national memorial, make it about war, poverty, or equality. Something! Don't make a federal case out of something as trifling as doing the cha-cha slide under Thomas Jefferson's nose. But the kid still thrills to hear Kevin Bacon tell parents in the small town that's band dancing in the 1984 film Footloose, it's our time to dance. It's our way to celebrate life. The whole point of free speech is that government shouldn't decide what is worthy of it. I call John Lithgow, the thoughtful actor who played the conflicted minister in Footloose, who believes dancing is wicked. I'm not a lawyer or clergyman, John reminded me, though I've played them many times. These folks are creating a flash mob, he said, an almost meditative moment passing as a great party. It may be a spectacle, but that's an act of creation. Tell them it's illegal and it makes it even more appealing to them. As long as they're aware of the consequences and accept them, who am I to judge? And you're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week, the online coupon provider Groupon and music streaming site Pandora announced they're going to be going public. These announcements come after the successful IPO, or initial public stock offering, of the business social networking site LinkedIn just a couple of weeks ago. Other social media companies are reportedly interested in going public now, because of the money they see other companies earning. Joined now by Beverly Macy, marketing executive. She teaches social media marketing at the UCLA Business and Management Extension Program. She joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And why are these companies earning all this money?
Well, they're fundamentally good businesses, and they've got a worldwide stage in which to operate. And they're also capitalizing on things that matter to people. In the case of Groupon, everybody loves a deal. Mm-hmm. So they're capitalizing on that.
Well, a company, though, like LinkedIn, had its IPO a couple of weeks ago, we mentioned, is reportedly now worth billions of dollars. But they actually earned less than $10 million last year. Now, that's not to be sniffed at, but what makes them worth billions when they have only earned a little under $10 million so far?
Great question. There's kind of two camps. There's the people scratching their heads saying that kind of thing, and are we repeating a bubble? And then there's the new group that says maybe we're in a boom. Maybe there really is something to the networking effect that we've all been kind of part of, watching Facebook get as big as it has. And LinkedIn is interesting because they actually cater to a very high demographic, well-educated, earning capacity is high. It's a lot of business to business. The advertising, et cetera, is really slated to be quite meaningful. And they've done some smart things, so we'll see. It's a we'll see story.
I understand, for example, how a car company makes money or doesn't. They make cars. It is not clear to me how a company like LinkedIn makes money.
Well, right now it's primarily in subscriptions to the higher premiums that LinkedIn offers, as well as advertising. And that's really the revenue model. They are working on other things, and they will get there, but that's primarily what it is. It's a sponsored subscription model.
It's an advertising medium
like a magazine.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, I gather from what you've written before, you don't fear that this is a bubble. And we should explain that in the 1990s, companies paid millions for anything with a .com after it, and a lot of these companies went bust.
It's not a bubble yet. So LinkedIn, even though the numbers are not where they're hoping they're going to be shortly, mm-hmm. they are a fundamentally good business. Groupon is often called the fastest growing company in history and is making money. And the rest of the agenda, if you will, Zynga and Facebook and Twitter, are all on deck to do quite well revenue and profit-wise. So that's what will separate this from the dot-com era.
And what does it say about the U.S. economy? What does it say about the world economy that U.S. car manufacturers, which make hard goods, need federal intervention, but companies that seem to exist mostly on potential earnings make this kind of money?
Fascinating, isn't it? I think we are in a very interesting, globally connected world. People are seeing a lot of money being dangled in front of them. Let's hope that it all lives up to the hype.
Beverly Macy, author of The Power of Real-Time Social Media Marketing, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
40 years ago this month, President Richard Nixon officially introduced what he called the War on Drugs. A decade later, Ronald Reagan launched it as a national crusade.
It's time, as Nancy said, for America to just say no to drugs.
Since then, though, the Obama administration has thrown out the term war on drugs, and this past week, the Global Commission on Drug Policy issued a report calling the crusade a failure. But back in the 1970s, the U.S. fight against drugs, especially marijuana, didn't seem like a war at all. In fact, for the gentlemen smugglers bringing bales of pot into Florida and South Carolina, it was a party, complete with a Jimmy Buffett soundtrack.
Wasting away again in Margaritaville.
Journalist Jason Ryan has written a new book about those days. It's called Jackpot, High Times, High Seas, and the Sting That Launched the War on Drugs. And he admits, South Carolina isn't really the first state that comes to mind when you think of the international drug trade.
I think most people imagine Miami, New York, L.A., these metropolises, not the South.
But there was a history of this. There is this kind of connection to the smuggling routes and smuggling trades that dates way back, right?
Right. I argued that the smugglers, the pot smugglers, or the gentleman smugglers, followed in the footsteps of a couple people. First, the pirates, Blackbeard the pirate, Stede Bonnet. Then during the Civil War, blockade runners. And then in the 30s during Prohibition, the rum runners also used the South Carolina coast. It has so many waterways and inlets and rivers that go into the ocean, but even the customs and DEA didn't have boats until the mid-70s to patrol it. So they were doing it by car, which was very inefficient.
So let's talk about these guys. First of all, you call them gentlemen smugglers. Why?
there were atypical drug smugglers. Nowadays, we take for granted that violence accompanies all types of drug trafficking. And certainly in Mexico, there are many, many horrible acts of gruesome violence and murders. But back in the 70s, these smugglers were college educated and they were also averse to violence. They reasoned that if there was plenty of money to go around, and it was as much about the fun as it was the money, so there's no reason to carry a gun.
So for them, this was just a good time and a way to make some quick, easy cash.
Right. It started out a lot of fun. Slowly, I think greed creeped into the picture. But when you think about the places they sailed, they often took sailboats down to Jamaica, to Colombia, South America. So it was nice adventure sailing, tons of pot and liquor on board to get you through the trip, even if it got a little boring. And when you came home, you had a nice landscape and friends waiting for you.
And one of those friends you talk about as part of the backdrop, the community of these folks, especially in Florida, down in the Keys, was Jimmy Buffett. Can you paint us a picture of how he fit into this and what that culture was like down there?
Sure. As Jimmy Buffett was making his name and starting to become a music superstar, his friends included some of the gentlemen marijuana smugglers. Mr. Buffett owned up to tossing a few bales of pot himself in a Rolling Stone article back in the 70s. It's tough to say if Buffett inspired the smugglers or the smugglers inspired Buffett's songs, but I think it was probably a little bit of both.
You end up portraying these gentlemen smugglers almost like folk heroes. I'm thinking especially about Les Riley. Can you tell me a little bit about this particular smuggler?
Sure. Les Riley grew up in Columbia and attended the University of South Carolina, but did not finish. Head out for the Keys, and he found a utopia there. He could make a living cutting lawns, but soon he found that instead of going out for a day of shrimping, it was much easier to head down to Jamaica for a few hundred pounds of pot. So he kind of fell into smuggling by accident. And from his perspective, money was important, but quality of life was more important. And I think you would struggle to find a victim associated with his alleged crimes, unless you want to make the argument that any kind of drugs brought into the United States causes moral decay or something like that. But otherwise, there are hardly any victims. He was delivering a product very much in demand.
But it was illegal, and he knew he was breaking the law.
It was illegal, though, in the 70s. In 11 states, having possession of small amounts of marijuana was not a criminal offense. Also, Jimmy Carter had argued to Congress that marijuana should be decriminalized, though they ignored him. And when Reagan came to power a few years later, he changed things and went full force against marijuana, making it public enemy number one.
Reagan launches this new, more robust war on drugs. Henry McMaster becomes the South Carolina U.S. attorney, and he really takes this on as his own mission.
Yes, he was a young politician looking to make a name for himself, and he came up with this idea through a little bit of help from some colleagues to create a task force to target drug smuggling in South Carolina, and they named it Operation Jackpot. They didn't know who was smuggling in South Carolina, but they knew drugs were coming in somehow. And so he basically gave the case to a customs agent and an IRS agent and said, the drugs are coming in, find out who's doing it.
And what happened?
They were scratching their heads when they got their orders, and they're just wondering what they were going to do, how they're going to find these men. Eventually, they struck upon the tactic of visiting local realtors and car dealers and asking, has anyone young made large cash transactions, purchased nice homes, purchased nice cars, paying in cash? And they got a couple names or they got a couple properties. And when they were able to start tracing the paper trail, they saw that they were registered to offshore corporations and that certain local attorneys had facilitated this paperwork and the closings. And then they're able to turn the screws on these attorneys and get more information out of them. And they really started picking up steam. And in 1983, issued the first indictments, which were for 42 people, accusing them of close to $1 billion worth of smuggling.
Did I read that you'd actually interviewed at least one of these guys? Is that right?
I was fortunate to interview many of the kingpins, and that was the best part of the research, was sitting down with them and some other smugglers and some law enforcement agents, too, and just hearing all the war stories of all the close calls at sea, of surviving hurricanes and sinking ships, of paying off partners with gemstones.
In your conversations with these smugglers, now that they're on the other side, having served their prison terms, did they express to you any regrets?
No, but in some ways it's a silly question when I ask if you could do it all over again, would you? Or do you have any regrets? Because there's no changing what happened. There's no getting back that time spent in prison. And I don't think even if deep down the smugglers felt like they have regrets, I don't think they would own up to them. They're very proud people. And I think that they don't believe they did anything wrong. They're simply out to have a good time and they weren't bothering anyone in their eyes.
Jason Ryan is the author of Jackpot, High Times, High Seas, and The Sting That Launched the War on Drugs. Jason, thanks so much for joining us.
I love being here. Thank you.
Dr. Jack Kevorkian, the pathologist who assisted in suicides, died yesterday. NPR's Don Gagne opens his reporter's notebook.
I first became aware of Jack Kevorkian many, many months before he helped his first person die. He lived in Royal Oak, Michigan. I lived in Royal Oak, Michigan. He was kind of the neighborhood eccentric. You'd see him at the grocery store. Except we knew he had this invention, something he called a suicide machine. And it was kind of this erector set contraption with a metal rack and a broomstick top and bags of liquid and tubes all over the place. And over on one side, a push button hooked to a little electric motor and a battery. And that's the button you would push to start the fluids flowing. We never thought he'd use it. Then one day, he did. This is a videotape that he made where he's giving instructions to the woman who would become the first person he helped die.
Now, Janet, you know, you know what you're asking me to do. Mm-hmm. You realize that?
Yes.
Okay. You want help from me?
I do.
Right. You realize that I can make arrangements for everything, and you have to do it. That you have to push the button.
I understand.
That's Dr. Kevorkian talking to 54-year-old Janet Adkins. She would become his first. She'd been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Much of Jack Kevorkian's public life took place in courtrooms because he was on trial a lot. Eventually ended up going to jail. He was always defiant. He often clashed with prosecutors, as he does here.
Laws like that have been passed throughout history, the Dark Ages.
And you just view once again that this is another one of the Dark Ages laws, correct?
Oh, absolutely. It will be so seen in 10 years. I look at the law like it will be seen in 10 years.
So now that he's gone, there's a story that sums him up best for me. It goes back to that very first time I met him, the morning after the first suicide. I told him that everybody I had talked to since I'd heard, I'd asked about it, and that I was hearing a couple of things. A lot of people were appalled. A lot of people supported him, but I said, even some of those people who support you think you're kind of a Dr. Frankenstein character. He looked at me, and he leaned in very close, 6 inches away, in this dark apartment, and said, have you read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein? I nodded that I had. After a pause, he said, then you know Frankenstein wasn't the monster. Society was the monster. I got a little chill. But that moment sums up his intellect, his defiance, and his theatricality. I'm Don Gagne.
This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time for sports. Lena beat Francesca Schiavone. Why do I? Schiavone. Well, she lost in two sets today to win the French Open Women's Championship. Lena becomes the first singles player from China to ever win a Grand Slam tournament. NPR's Mike Pesca joins us. Mike, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
Lena was pretty convincing, wasn't she?
She has a great and exciting game because there's nothing really that stands out about it except how overall solid she is. And she is so fast. She gets to all these balls. And so even on a surface that she herself admitted wasn't her best, clay, she said, I didn't think I could win on clay. Mm-hmm. She makes every game, she makes winning a possibility in every game. And I do think that this is something of a watershed moment because, like you said, no Chinese national has ever won a Grand Slam single event. From the time we woke up this morning to now, I think we have a new either most or one of the most popular female athletes on the planet. And I just say that because China gets behind their athletes. They always vote the basketball player Yao Ming onto the all-star team, even when he's hurt and doesn't play. I was just looking at Lina's Wikipedia page. It's up to 7,500 words, which is like 3,000 more than Martina Hingis, a slightly more accomplished tennis player. So I think Lina is going to be a marketing sensation. And she has a great personality. She speaks English. She's funny. She thanked the ball boys in victory. How often do you see that?
Yeah. Well, all right. Good. Well, good to have her there in the top tier. Of course, in the men's semifinal yesterday, Roger Federer seemed to turn back the clock, back to 2007. Novak Djokovic hadn't lost in what, 5 months?
It was 43 straight, which was a record. And so everyone had said, well, we're not going to get another great Rafael Nadal versus Roger Federer finals. But guess what? We are, because Federer showed that thunderous serve and showed that he hasn't slipped that much. And these pairings between Nadal and Federer, they're almost always amazing tennis matches. Federer, obviously the greatest tennis player of all time, but there is an asterisk there. If you're a Nadal fan, you will point out that Nadal has beat him twice as much as Federer has beaten Nadal. But then the Federer defenders will say, yes, but that's because most of those Nadal victories have come on clay, and Nadal could very well be, I think there's no debate, greatest clay player of all time.
And to keep up the theme of aging athletes behaving well, hey, Dirk Nowitzki, NBA Finals, he sunk the final basket to cap off a real fourth quarter comeback by the Dallas Mavericks. Miami Heat had been up by 15 points. The question is, can they do it for three more games?
I think that they can. I'm not sure that they will, but I think that this certainly hurts Miami's confidence, because LeBron James and Dwayne Wade seem to think, with about 6 or 7 minutes left in that game, wow, we're going up 2-0. We're halfway to the NBA championship. Now, analysis of that game is very much like a Rorschach test. It's really the basketball equivalent of glass half full or half empty to ask, as many people have, was that a Mavericks comeback or a Heat collapse? It was obviously parts of both. Mm-hmm. But the fact that the Heat just couldn't score, really only 3 points in the last 7 minutes, and the fact that LeBron James decided to do all the scoring for his team instead of involving his teammate Dwayne Wade, who had 36 points up to that point, that does pose a problem for the future of the Heat.
Yeah. We can't leave basketball this week without noting the retirement of Shaquille O'Neal.
He leaves us speechless, even though he's almost never. Shaquille O'Neal was a great basketball player. If you look at the stats, fifth all-time on scoring and great rebounder. But what a personality.
Yeah.
What a genuinely funny guy. And even though he did quasi-apologize for the horrible movies he starred in over the years, like Kazam and Steel, he is the kind of guy that you're going to want to see be in the public eye. During his retirement speech, he did thank his dad, an Army sergeant, profusely, and said, Dad, if I had listened to you and learned to shoot free throws better, I might be number one on the all-time scoring list. But he had fun playing basketball, and we had fun watching him, and he gave lie to that old Will Chamberlain quote that nobody roots for Goliath.
NPR's Mike Pesca, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Scott.